Thank you. Thank you. This is really a great honor and a lot of fun to be invited to give this talk. It's going to be not a real technical talk, but I like to call it a kind of cultural talk. I like to use this image of a glass bead game. Does anybody know what these kids are doing? We never, it's not very popular anymore. But back in Germany in the 1930s, Hermann Hesse was a writer and a painter, and he won the Nobel Prize in 1946, citing his book, The Glass Bead Game, which was his last published work, actually. It's a story that takes place in the future, so I think in the 25th century, in which glass beads are tokens that represent concepts in science, technology, culture, and society. The rules of the game are very mystical. They're not really well explained in the book, but it's described as a game that takes years of study of music, mathematics, cultural history, and essentially an abstraction of arts and sciences, and the players needing to make connections between seemingly disparate fields. And I like to make the connection between glass beads and what Richard Dawkins calls memes, cultural ideas, which can be transmitted from one person to another, quale, which are philosophical terms describing conscious experiences, and Platonic forms, which you might know from the allegory of the cave, for example, but essences of various objects. And so since we're here in San Antonio, I think some things, like the taste of tequila, could be qualified for almost any of these things. And one of the concepts that really inspires me is just the linkage between vision, body, and the brain, the very tight linkage. And so in making holograms, which you're welcome to come up and see after the talk, I like to think that the things that are at arm's length that you can actually reach out and are within your realm of touch, that kind of loop, very physical, visceral loop, is important to successful technology. And so equivalents of the glass bead game. Today, I like to think of these things as kind of related. Any kind of great conversation is a trading of good of things. And I like to think of the barriers between genres and between boundaries. And when you think about film genres, and you put any two film genres together, you can pretty much, it's been done. Like Western comedy, you probably, many people seen Blazing Saddles, or a mystery historical movie. There's anybody here know the Oscar-winning movie from 1956, Anastasia? I like to think of mixing these up, and I took all the departments at University of Virginia and put it into the online Wordle thing, and you just see all the names that are mixed up in the university departments. But I think so many universities and companies have very high walls between their departments. And it's kind of fun to take any two random words and like molecular architecture, which is really kind of nanotechnology, or thought engineering, which is like mass hypnosis or the movie Inception. So in a sense, we're playing a simple version of the glass bead game, kind of like Mad Libs, I suppose. And I like to look at this image, too. This is somebody poured plaster down the hole where an ant colony lived in the ground, and then dug up the ant the result, and that's what this is. And I like to think of playing the glass bead game in a larger sense as being kind of a large brain, a society and culture being a large game. And so in this talk today, there are just a few things to structure it. It's going to be very loosely structured, and I'm going to jump around a lot to many different themes. And so I think James Clerk Maxwell in 1864 was a really masterful glass bead game player, because he took the four concepts, Gauss's law of electricity, Faraday's law of induction, Gauss's law for magnetism, and Ampere's law, and saw all the connections between them. And now they're known as Maxwell's equations. And I don't know if many of you know, but he also was responsible for the tricolor theory and proposed making tricolor holograms, which his colleague Thomas Sutton did in 1861 to illustrate one of Maxwell's talks. And then Gabriel Lippmann won a Nobel Prize in 1908 for a technique, a different method of color photography. And the image on the right was made in 1891. And the technique was to float emulsion on mercury, a very reflected surface. And when the light hit the mercury very close to the reflective surface, it formed a standing wave pattern, which in a high-resolution emulsion formed an interference filter, which can depict the color of whatever the natural scene was. So he won the Nobel Prize in 1908, although this is not a very frequently used technique anymore. And diffraction is something that a lot of people don't feel comfortable with, I don't think. Here's an example of looking down at a ocean scene with two rocks and waves going by the rocks, and you can see the curve of the waves after they pass through the rocks. So essentially diffraction is the curving a wavefront after passing by a barrier. And here's a symbolic representation of that. And then if you have two slits with diffracting light bending out from the slit, you can have them interfere with each other, creating that kind of moiré pattern, which is the basis of transmission holography, forming a very fine line pattern, which you can then diffract light and control it. In nature, I think people like looking at the blue morpho butterfly, and it's quite beautiful color is caused by the structure inside its wings. It's using melanin and a very fine, I think 200 nanometer cracks in its wing, which resonate at 400 nanometers, which is blue light. And very similar to zebra's holograms, which are shown below. They are also interference filters. And you can see there's a pencil point pointing to the little small elemental holograms. We call those little elements hogels. So it's kind of similar to the word pixel. We use the word hogel. And of course, even peacocks have a similar color mechanism. So sometimes I talk to completely non-technical audiences, and I mentioned that there's really not much of the pigment in these animals, and people are surprised and gasp. The rainbow puddle, another example, after a rain when oil floats to the top of water. This is probably something you all know pretty well. And in case you didn't see them earlier, I'm going to pick up a couple holograms to show you. So here's one that we did a long time ago. Can you see this? Yes? So, and you can see I'm tipping it up and down a little bit and side to side. So as you can see, this is what we call full parallax. It's got the full range of visibility that a natural object would have if I actually had the object itself. And if you go through the Austin Airport, there's some holograms up above one of the exit doors. There's a big guitar and then a turtle and then some optical fibers sticking out at you. So next time you go through Austin Airport, please look out for those. And so what we're essentially doing is we're recording and playing back a full parallax light field. And if you're Dr. Raskar's talk this morning, he briefly touched on the planoptic camera or the planoptic function. And so light field is something that is you can record basically all the light rays passing through little elements, or little sampled elements in space. And that's essentially what these hogels do. And then below it, I'm trying to make this connection again and again with like glass beads. And that's actually the image off of a fly's eye. And so sometimes we make holograms that are called fly's eye images. So I'm going to show you now, I'm going to disconnect this projector and plug it into this other projector and project it onto you. Oh, I know. see. Okay, so imagine this projector. I'm not going to try to blind you with this, but imagine this is a Hoagle. Now, you should be seeing different colors at different angles. So as I project this onto you, sometimes you'll see red, sometimes you'll see blue, sometimes you'll see green. Getting that? Now imagine that this projector is just one Hoagle. And if I hold it steady, people in the front will see red and people over in the back will see green. So you're going to see different things, different colors, depending on your angle. Just point this back again. Okay, there we go. And another animal that has interference filters built into it are animals that, like cats and owls, that have the same kind of melanin structures in their eyes, and they retro-reflect like glass beads, which I'll get back to again. This is Dennis Gabor. He's credited as the inventor of holography, and he coined the term hologram. And he also won the Nobel Prize in 1979. And the way that he came up with the idea of holography was standing in line to play tennis in 1947, when he was working on a problem with X-ray imagery, X-ray optics. And he suddenly realized basically the technique of interfering an object beam with a reference beam, which I'll mention. Here's the technique. Basically, you take two coherent light beams and you combine them together, and it forms a very fine interference pattern in space. And if you put high-resolution film there and record that fine line pattern, then you develop it. Then later, you shine light on it, and it will recreate the wavefront, the other wavefront. So that's the basic notion. And here's how you might make a hologram of an object. In this case, it's if you can see it, it's a skull, human skull, sideways on the back of the table. And I'm showing two laser beams, one we're calling the object beam, and then the one that's called the reference beam, and they have to shine simultaneously onto the recording plate in order to form the very complex interference pattern, which will then, if you re-illuminate it with the reference beam, it will reconstruct the object beam. And Emmett Leith, back in the early 60s, I think 1964, he was a professor at the University of Michigan. And with his colleague, Upatniak, they were the first to use a laser to create this kind of image. And it was actually only later that he discovered that that Dennis Gabor had written a paper on the same technique in the 1940s. And so, and then they started using the term hologram. And my professor, Steve Benton, came along in the 60s, also in the late 60s, and created a version of holography that was visible in white light, and it's called the rainbow hologram. So the hologram over, the image of the hologram on the right is a rainbow hologram, and it was actually an image of a model of the MIT Media Lab building that was being constructed in 1985. And this poster was being shown around and got me excited, and that's why I applied to the program. The idea at the time that I thought it was doing was showing that you could show a hologram and then imagine the building, exactly where the building was, as if it were a window. And that was actually, I guess, it gives you a false impression that you can do that, because when you hold a hologram like that in your hand, you're really only holding a scale model, like a small image of the building. It's not like you can see the giant image of the building in the space where the building will be built. So it's kind of that image is not quite accurate. And at the time, also, I became acquainted with my colleague Kaveh Bizargan, who's in the back of the room, and he was responsible for a technique to make those rainbow holograms achromatic, a very important technique. And those rainbow holograms are the ones on your credit card today, too, by the way. And then Yuri Denisyuk was responsible for another form of holography that also could be viewed in white light, and it's very similar to the kind that I now make. These holograms that you really can control the color. And here's the basics. So instead of having the object beam and the reference beam come from different sides of the plate, they, I'm sorry, from the same side, they come from opposite sides. And they create different fringe patterns that are more or less parallel to the sides of the recording plate. So that's really similar to the way the blue morpho butterfly works or the eyes of a cat. You're forming fringes that filter out, that are interference filters, and tune the color, the narrow band wavelength of light that you're interested in. And another thing that I like to make an analogy towards is just to help people understand these images is, you know, people are not very startled looking in the mirror every morning and seeing a fully dynamic, full color, full motion, three-dimensional display that they absolutely know is only on a two-dimensional surface. They don't seem to think that's remarkable, but it is. We still can't really approach that yet with any other technology. But imagine if you could have a switch that you could press when you're looking in the mirror and it would just freeze all the light coming off the mirror. That would be a mirror with a memory. That would be very much like what these holograms do. So now I'm going to talk about 3D displays and imagination. And does everybody know who that is? Right. And of course, this is a using persistence of the time it takes to record on the film. He couldn't see that line that he was drawing, really. So Johannes Gutenberg, back in the 14th century, before he started working with movable type, was selling small mirrors that were mirrors that you could bring with you on pilgrimages to visit relics in churches. And people thought that they could hold these small mirrors up and that the light that hit the mirror would be recorded there, that they could bring these little mirrors home with them and or put them, mount them on their hats or on their clothing, and that when they got home, they could show their friends and their family and say, look, you see the relic that I was... And people imagined that they could see the relics, the religious relics. The marketing phrase at the time Johannes Gutenberg used was, bring home a little holiness. Or just bring home holiness. Anyway, he got sued because of a delivery problem. And so the legal records exist, and that's how we know that he even did this. And if you go to University of Texas in Austin, and you go into the lobby of the Harry Ransom Center, you will see a Johannes Gutenberg Bible sitting next to the world's first photograph there in the lobby. Those are probably the two most famous objects in the Harry Ransom Center's collection, so they make them very prominent. And it's kind of interesting, the connection between those two things, knowing that Johannes Gutenberg was responsible for selling these pilgrim mirrors, and Niepce, who made the world's first photograph in 1826, and that photograph is recorded on a metal plate, which looks very much like a hologram because you cannot look at it straight on. You have to look at it at an angle, and it's a scene out of his window in his estate in France, which is kind of recreated there in the lower right-hand corner so that you can see it a little better. And it's similar to this science fiction story that I know about that Bob Shaw wrote, and he won a Hugo Award for in 1967. And it's The Light of Other Days, a story that introduced the concept of slow glass. And slow glass is glass with a very high index of refraction, so high that it takes minutes or hours or days for light to pass through it. And he expanded on the concept and part of the idea was that little pebbles or little pellets of this slow glass could be anywhere in your realm, and they could be recording anything at any time. And so therefore the concept of cameras and loss of privacy was brought up in the actually a murder occurs in the story, and one of the aspects of the story is that the law system adapts so that they decide that they're going to hold court on things that they know that they'll find out later by looking at the glass, but they're not going to rely on the glass. Kind of interesting concept. And then later, 1999, Lena Verstegard at Howe at the Rowland Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, actually slowed down the group velocity of light packets I think 8 miles an hour or 38 miles an hour, and then in 2001 she actually was able to momentarily stop light completely. So there you go, from fantasy to reality. And so I'm just pausing for a second to show you that this is the way my talk is going to go. This is kind of a monologue, and is ideally a glass bead game would be a conversation between two different people, but I'm just going to keep on riffing with these ideas that I think are connected. So an artist named Jim Campbell has created a work about memory in which there's a video camera looking out at the audience, at the observers in the gallery, and it's a work that travels around the world. Anybody who goes and observes this artwork in a gallery might be captured, and the artwork is designed so that it will randomly reproject or re-display any of the imagery that's taken with the camera. It might be imagery that was taken a moment ago, a minute ago, an hour ago, or maybe a year ago. And this work has existed for over a decade now, and it's traveled around the world, and I know people that have seen it and felt it was very poignant because they went to see the art show with a friend who has since passed away, for example, and they see by accident, they just happen to see an image of themselves with their friend years ago when they go back again to look at this artwork. And the same artist, Jim Campbell, has also done this image called A Portrait of a Portrait of Claude Shannon. And as you may know, Claude Shannon is considered the father of information theory. And this this image, it's his obituary photograph that goes into random kind of noise and then over time settles into the image of Claude Shannon, although very low sampled rate. As you can see in the middle frame, it's a bunch of LEDs that are very widely spaced apart and then a diffuser out in front of it. And so if you know what Claude Shannon looked like, you can kind of make him out on the far right. There's another image that the same artist did about Harry Nyquist, kind of similar, the father of sampling theory. And then talking about Claude Shannon makes me think of Claude Glass. And Claude Glass, it was named after an artist named Claude Lorrain, who lived in the 17th century. And he was famous for this style of painting that looks kind of a bit washed out, landscapes. People admired the sensitive coloration of his paintings. And the way he did them was by using a dark piece of glass that he carried around in a case. And so he would hold the glass out in front of the landscape that he would want to paint, and he looked at the reflection off the glass and then really painted off the reflection of the glass. And he inspired a whole school of painters who did the same thing. They didn't really believe that the image was captured in the glass the way that they did in the 15th century with Gutenberg, but it's still reminiscent. And that also makes me think of Star Trek. Does anybody know this episode, 1966? Yes? This really got me excited when I was a kid. It was it's one of those planets where people go on vacation, and so the whole crew went to this planet where it seemed that anything that they thought would appear. So if you happen to be thinking of Alice in Wonderland or being attacked by a samurai or a knight, it would happen on this island. And that antenna in the middle apparently was capturing people's thoughts, and then using same technology as the teleporter used, they could actually create physical manifestations of the characters that people were thinking about. And as you know, the teleporter is a concept of actually of reading this physical structure, transmitting it, and then reconstructing it on another location, which reminds me of The Fly, which of course we know didn't work out very well. And then I don't know if you remember Wonka Vision, but there was a scene in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory in which they capture a little boy, and the trick there too was that he gets miniaturized when he gets transmitted. And then later on with Star Trek The Next Generation, they started using the holodeck concept. And in the holodeck, it's a room that projects light off of the walls of the room, and also uses, I think, a version of transporter technology to create physical objects also. So it's kind of a hybrid. And That reminds me of the experiments to capture the neutrinos, the neutrino experiments that are in underground locations all over the world, including this one that's in Japan. You can see the sensors all over. Those are really photomultiplier tubes, but they look like cameras. And in 2000, one of them imploded and then caused a chain reaction. So a whole lot of them imploded all at the same time. And they fixed the problem by pulling out the bad ones and then kind of dispersing the ones that remained good. And it's still, I believe it's still in operation today. And that reminds me of this camera array, which was being developed at Stanford University in the mid-2000s. A lot of interesting work went on with this camera array for capturing. And of course, you know, the eyes of the peacock kind of look similar, which reminds me of Argus, the Greek myth, you know, the servant of Hera, who was supposed to be watching Io, the white bull, you know, who was actually some nymph, I think. Anyway, which looks like a compound eye. Like a fly, fly's eye. And this was an interesting animal that in 2001, the biologist studying it discovered that it actually has little crystalline eyes all over its body, whereas it was thought not to have any eyes before. So it went from having no eyes to having only eyes covering its body. So there it is on a very small scale. So crystalline, actual crystalline lenses forming images. And of course, you know, I'd be remiss not to mention Princess Leia, because it's so prevalent. It's everybody references Princess Leia when they talk about three-dimensional display technology and holograms. But the thing that's closest to what Princess Leia looked like in the movie is this this technology by Fogscreen, a Finnish company that debuted in 2002. It's not really 3D, it's projecting video onto a fog screen that's laminar flowing fog, water vapor. But it can float out in space, and it seems 3D for that reason. Minority Report, 2002 also, looks like it's projecting holograms from many different angles out into space. And just like Princess Leia seemed like it was noisy video, this one also seems to be low res, and that seems to make it more, even that more real. And the limitations of the technology are what make it more compelling in these movies. Although, of course, what we're trying to do is make technology that is indiscernible from reality eventually. And then it kind of bugs me when CNN calls something a hologram. I don't know if, raise your hand if you saw this or if you know about it. Okay. So there was this this display during the election in 2008, in which in Chicago there was a reporter, and then in New York they had another reporter and a set, and they took basically a ring of video cameras around the woman in Chicago and simulated any camera angle that they moved the physical camera in New York at. So it looked as if, by just matting 2D video, it looked as if they were in the same physical location. And they called it a hologram, although they haven't done it since, as far as I know. And then Prince Charles was beamed to in Abu Dhabi to an energy summit, and it was a pretty simple notion of using a transparent screen and projecting 2D video onto that transparent screen. So an image that seems to float in space, even if it's a 2D image, if it's in space, people perceive it as a 3D image. And this is people watching Avatar, right? Could be. Things haven't changed much since 1830s, when Charles Wheatstone first understood that we see in stereo, and as we now, and many of us grew up with those Viewmasters. And if you on your table, some of you have these neutral density filters, which I wanted to show. If you hold it up in front of your left eye, you should see this in 3D using the Pulfrich effect. Raise your hand if you've heard of the Pulfrich effect before. So some of you have. It's a technique. It was discovered by Carl Pulfrich in 1922. And interestingly, he didn't have stereo vision himself, so he never actually could perceive this. But raise your hand if you can see this in 3D. Oh, good. Not everybody can. And you know, about 5% of the population can't fuse stereo. So I wouldn't be surprised if some of you couldn't. But the way this is supposed to work, the theory is that when you hold a neutral density filter in front of one of your eyes, it slows down the time it takes to process that image. So when you have something that's moving, you're going to get a disparity between your left and right eye view by holding the filter. But we don't use that much because it really is restricted only to imagery that's moving. And there was a father and son pair, the Iveses, that are very important in the development of three-dimensional displays. The father, Herbert Eugene, came up with the parallax panoramagram, and I think, Frederick was the father. A barrier, a raster barrier, a putting a, it's like a picket fence in front of something, in front of an image that controls the directionality of light. And then his son improved on it with lens sheets, which were more efficient. So you get brighter images. The most hyper-realistic thing I've ever seen in terms of an image that is not what it appears to be are these hyper-realistic holograms that are made from with three colored lasers of real objects, in this case a collection of insects. And a sheet of film is held out in front of that set of insects, and then a single beam of laser light is shown through the transparent film and reflects off of the object, the insects, and then travels back into the film and causes a hologram to be recorded. It looks similar to the zebra holograms here. Back in the 1800s, an inventor named Francois Willem came up with a photographic process called photosculpture, in which he would record the profile of an object or a person and then actually make a physical object based on it. And you may know that the Lumiere brothers experimented, the same Lumiere brothers that developed early film technology, also experimented a little bit with three-dimensional displays. In fact, what you're seeing here is a photograph of Auguste Lumiere taken with different depths of fields. And then they were combined together into a slice stack display. So on sheets of glass that were transparent, they were just mounted together, just like the one on the far right. And then this central image is a picture of the slice stack object, which is in the collection of the Musée Carnavalet in Paris, which I believe if you go and you call ahead, you can actually have a look at. And it reminds me of Jell-O. that's a slice stack too. The problem with slice stacks is that they're transparent, so you see through them, and you cannot have a real opaque objects depicted. Same thing's true with this swept display, the company called Actuality, that has a rotating panel under the dome, and it's changing what's on the rotating panel in time, and so using persistence of vision, it's addressing, you might call, voxels inside that dome. So you can't put your hand in there, of course, because it's covered with glass, and if the glass wasn't there, your hand would be hit by the rotating panel. Another swept display was made in Germany called Felix 3D. That was active in the mid-90s through the mid-2000s. But that's that sail-like image, and video was being projected on it at a high rate while it was rotating to fill the space. And then there's other technologies to deform mirrors and to try to form objects by addressing a volume out in space. Sony's doing something. If you went to SIGGRAPH this year, you would have seen this kind of object, similar technology. And a couple SIGGRAPHs ago, there was an interesting display by the Japanese National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology, in which they were actually ionizing air out in space, and it made a really loud pop, and you could smell the ionized air. Not real practical, but quite impressive. And this is a video from Tom Clancy's game called End War, which now Zebra is being funded by government, and this was kind of a shock for us to see, because we were developing a display that's similar to looking in that it's an emissive display that's meant for a military purpose. And we thought, wow, the games were really, it's hard for us to keep up with the imagination of popular culture. Although I think, so one of the themes of this talk is how imagination, popular culture, inspire the technology. So we imagine something, and then the scientists are inspired by it, and then make it happen. At the SIGGRAPH in New Orleans last year, there was this wonderful demonstration of a tactile hologram. There was an array of small, what do you call them? Sound,
ultrasound.
Sorry?
Ultrasound.
Ultrasound, yes. So they formed basically a hologram of pressure onto your hand. You could feel the tactile sense of something touching your hand. And at the same time, there was a two-dimensional video being projected off of a curved mirror, a parabolic mirror. And so you could put your hand out there and feel and see raindrops, and then feel the individual, the sensation of the individual raindrops touching your hand as they drop down. And I love these kind of demonstrations because they're really done on the cheap by graduate students, and they're very visceral, very dramatic, and show great potential, I think, for the future. And at the MIT Media Lab, in this last couple of years, they've been working on an interesting project called the Bi-Die Screen, or Bi-Directional Screen. And although it's not a three-dimensional display, it could be, it's using a raster barrier, like a fly's eye, an array of pinholes, to sense three dimensions of what's in front of the screen. So if you have a bright light, you need a bright light in front of the screen, and you put your hand out there, it can sense your hand in space, and then it can you can gesture or you can manipulate objects, and it responds very quickly. So here's just a summary slide. These are the kinds of things that I was showing you. Slice stacks that are static, and some of their persistence of vision, and fly's eye, refractive lenses, and of course my holograms are diffractive Hoagle fly's eye displays. So now I'm just going to go and tell you a little more detail what we're doing at Zebra. So in contrast to the other images I showed you of holography, these are recording individual Hoagles, sampled reflection holograms, and so we're computing imagery that's put on a spatial light modulator, and laser light is shone through it, and a reference beam interferes with it and creates a line pattern that's kind of similar to my shirt, which hence the name Zebra Imaging. And so there's a volumetric interference pattern produced on a photopolymer. And so here are the kind of steps involved. You have to, step number one is get data, 3D digital data of some kind. Step number two is render it with a virtual camera that faces in two directions. And then it composites, we composite those images and put that single image, that single two-dimensional image on a LCD and shine laser light through it, and then record little Hoagles one at a time, and then process the film. And we get so that allows us to create any illusion that we want to, any light field that we can calculate or capture, we can put in a hologram. And then the imagers, the machinery that we use to make the holograms look like this, and now it's they're getting a little more professional looking with a skin on the outside, and then this is our latest looking imager. And we've been experimenting with haptic technology so that you can try to get the sense of touch. Haptic technology is where you have force feedback on some motors with a stylus. So the stylus has motors that put electrical forces that on the motors so that you feel like there's something solid that you're tapping against with that stylus. And we've also experimented with projecting video. So if you see it's playing, so just like earlier I was showing you video projected onto a hologram, illuminating the hologram, you can see that any content in the video is actually also projected onto the hologram. So that's what that's showing. And like a live scenario of some kind can animate a static hologram. So the static hologram is like the stage set and the video is like the action, although the video is only two-dimensional in that case. And we're working on a 3D display, which I can't go into much detail. It's government funded and we're still restricted on what we can say publicly about it, but I think that very soon we'll be able to describe it in more detail. It uses LiDAR as its input, and a company called Velodyne is making a LiDAR, is a time of flight technique for making three-dimensional scans of the world. And Velodyne is creating a LiDAR system that can scan 30 frames a second, so you can create a fresh three-dimensional model at video rates. So we're using that as input to our system. And they used LiDAR for Coldplay's popular music video. So you could see that he was singing and being captured at the same time in 3D. And then this is just a table, kind of comparison table of various techniques, frame rates and angles of view and depth cues. And we still think that the holograms have more capabilities than the slice stack and the spinning slices and the lenticulars and the raster barriers. And to kind of end my talk, this is the end my talk, I just wanted to mention this is kind of an amusing technology which was by Professor Tachi at Tokyo University. It gained a lot of attention in 2003 when he presented this work, which was meant to be a cloak of invisibility. He would have a video camera behind the person wearing this retro-reflecting coat, and whatever was being captured by the video camera was being projected onto the front of the jacket, and being a retro-reflector, it would shine right back at the, to the front, so it looked as if the person was invisible, theoretically. But if you can imagine, if you had a coat that had active Hogels on it, which is what we're making now at Zebra, you could, in theory, have a bunch of sensors and a bunch of... In fact, you can imagine a interspersed array of sensors and projectors. So input and output simultaneously in a fabric that would be capable of doing this, and almost anything would be capable of being the holodeck in Star Trek, The Next Generation. And this is kind of a summary slide, too, of different kinds of reflectivity. The incident light off of a standard mirror, just following Snell's law, with the angle of reflectance incidence and the angle of reflectance the same. And then diffusing a light off of any kind of Lambertian diffuser, like the wallpaper on the walls here. The retro-reflecting off of an array of glass beads, in which light will reflect back out at the same direction that it is incident in. And then to the right is the example of one of the holograms that I have here, in which you have incident light coming in at a specific angle, and then you completely control all the directions and intensities and colors coming off of that point. So again, coming back to this image of a collective mind, I'm hoping that with conversations and kind of cross-pollination of ideas, that we're going to come up with wonderful new inventions and solutions to problems we don't even know we have. So now I'd like to invite you all again. Anybody who feels like it, please come up. Feel free to come up here and look at the holograms. And I think in about 15 minutes, we're going to continue on the program with the next presentation. Thank you.